Hi, I'm Magda.
And I'm Katie, your co-host.
How We Built Our Team is a podcast that talks to successful founders and leaders in the hiring and recruiting space to learn their strategies for building and scaling their teams.
From attracting and impressing top talent to creating a strong company culture, our guests will share their insights and experience on what it takes to build your dream team.
In this episode, we have the privilege of diving into the amazing journey of Ahmed Elsamadisi, the founder of Narrator AI, which is a groundbreaking data analytics tool that promises to answer any data question in less than 10 minutes. Ahmed shares his insights and experiences, including his incredibly diverse background, which began with working on self-driving cars, human-robot interaction, and AI algorithms for missile defense, the challenges he faced while scaling WeWork's data team from the ground up, his unique perspective on finding the right balance between expertise and adaptability. Whether you're an entrepreneur or an enthusiast in the field of data analytics, this episode is super inspiring and informative and will hopefully give you a lot of tools and tips for the evolving landscape of hiring and data innovation. Today, we welcome Ahmed Elsamadisi to the podcast. He is the founder and CEO of Narrator. Narrator enables companies to make better decisions by providing them with the ability to answer any question in under 10 minutes, which is an amazing statement. He started his career building algorithms for self-driving cars and human-robot interaction, to name a few. He then joined Raytheon to develop AI algorithms for missile defense. And then in 2015, to top it all off, Ahmed worked with WeWork and was their first hire on the data team, then built their data engineering team from the ground up and grew the team of data engineers and analysts. We're really excited to have him on the show today. So welcome, Ahmed.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Your background is so incredible because it spans so many different industries and like life trajectories almost. So I'm curious if you can tell us about your journey from working on self-driving cars to founding Narrator. How did you get to this company today?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that I have always been obsessed with how people make decisions. Like, how do we go from such small thing like information to an action? And you can think about that in many folds. In self-driving cars, humans make hundreds of decisions. And when you go try to codify that and build algorithms for it, I feel like you begin learning more and more about how we humans make better decisions. And then changing that to missile defense, where it's like, high stakes, high accuracy required decisions, this super intense situation with like very little room for error. You understand how we make decisions in very high stress situations and how do you get accuracy and what you have to do. Shifting to WeWork, where you're helping executives make decisions, you're understanding a little bit more about the human psyche. Because like people like to think that executives have questions, you give them the data and they go, aha. Answer. And like that never happened. Like 80% of the job is like, how do you get them to ask the right question? How do you get a clean question? How do you give them the information? Like no plot has ever given anyone an answer. Like you have to explain the whole story before they're like, oh, I see it. And all that together culminated in Narrator, where I just realized that the difficulty to answer questions led people to give up on asking questions. And we saw that happen time and time again at many, many companies. It takes so long and it's so cumbersome to get your data team to answer questions that you stop asking them. And the better the question is, actually the harder it is to answer because of the way the systems work. So I wanted to change that by creating a way where you can standardize information so you can think through, develop stories, build detailed analyses and reuse them. And by allowing those things to happen, it just made it much, much easier to ask hundreds and hundreds of questions and get quick answers. And build a system that not only helped you get the answer, but also helped you make a decision, helped you communicate it, and best of all, helped you ask the question in the correct way.
Yeah, that's awesome. What inspired you to want to, you know, start your own company after being a part of so many high growth startups? And obviously you built your team at WeWork. Did that sort of influence the decision to found Narrator? Or
no, actually that was not it. Look, I realized that I had a problem that I was obsessed with, which was this like, if in the data space, like people who know about me, it's like a sub tiny, tiny problem within data that I care a lot about. But the idea of standardizing data to make it reusable was what I wanted to do. Like You hop on Salesforce, everyone uses the same exact structure. You hop Webflow, you can build a website. In data, every single person is starting from scratch and building everything their own. And you guys who are and people in analytics, you probably be like, how the hell is this not solved? Like HR is not asking unique questions, but every single team has thousands of data models and so much work done by the data team just to answer the same set of answers. And there's a very good reason why that exists. And it's a fundamental problem with how data is modeled. So I went out to solve that problem. And what I did was I actually looked for companies who have it solved. I went to a tour of all the big companies like Airbnb, Netflix. And everybody was like, that's just the reality of data. So I was like, well, I don't want to do that. So then I went to startups trying to solve this problem. And everyone tells the same thing, which is you want to standardize all of data so you can reuse? That's just it's the holy grail. It's not possible. You can't do that. All data is different. You can't just change how it's been done for 50 years. And that's kind of the common story when you try to find people who have solved the problem. You try to find people who are solving the problem and you realize that there's no one willing to tackle it. Then you start trying to get money so you can solve it yourself. And that's what I did. And when I started solving this problem, I knew what the input and output wanted to be. And I had a rough idea of how to do it. But it was not it was considered impossible. Actually, for the first 3 to 4 years of Narrator, what we were doing was considered impossible to standardize all of data into a single table and then be able to answer any question with that standard structure, no matter what industry or sector or anything you ask is. Even telling people nowadays, they're still like, wait, how is that possible? And then they see it, and as people start using it, and as a Narrator has grown, it's become more of an accepted way of this is an alternative.
I'm curious, at what time in your career did you realize this is a problem that you want to solve?
Awesome question. It's actually a lot more frustrating than I think. It felt like an aha moment. What happened was I got so angry at WeWork and how people are answering questions that I started something called Data Cult. And the idea was I would try to retrain people and how to ask and answer questions correctly. So it was a 2-week intensive thing where I'm like, people taught you data wrong and we're going to relearn it in the way that I first, in the way that I thought I did it. And Data Cult really exploded in WeWork several years. In my last year doing it, we had executives partake in it. And then once I left, somebody took it and grew it way further. It became an international experience at WeWork. And then somebody left and started a company called Data Culture that adopted that same structure. So this idea of retraining how people ask and answer questions was really critical out of anger of how people are doing it. And then what we discovered at the end of it was once we got people to ask and answer questions correctly, we just realized how cumbersome and difficult it is to actually deliver it. And within that, I had a little gem of knowledge, which was I know having implemented the data system 10 times and having iterated with all the current tools, I had a very specific pinpoint location where I'm like, this is why this thing becomes a clusterfuck. And I was like, I will solve this one tiny thing. And that's what we spent 3 years in the area rebuilding. And for anyone who knows anything about data, it's called a joy, how data gets connected. And we wanted to reinvent that. And we ended up creating a new way that works for more modern. I ended up studying a lot of actually history of why we do databases the way they do, how this came to be. And pretty much what happened in the world is always the same, where we adopt tech debt that becomes standard. The whole world is different now. And we've just been doing it the same exact way and haven't really adopted it. So when you get to rethink it, you're like, oh my God, if I was knowing what I know today, I would not design it this way. And then we get to redesign it. And then there's the whole fun of building a company where you're trying to do the lowest level different. So then you have to kind of rebuild the entire world because all of data exists in this one world. And we created this, it's known as a star schema. We created this thing called an activity schema, which is a new world. And then nothing supports it. So we had to go build an entire data stack. Looking back, that's been probably one of our biggest successes because now people get to use an end-to-end data product, hop in. Instead of buying 50 tools that you would use today, you can have one data analyst do the job of 10 people with one tool that's end-to-end. And that's why people buy Narrator. It's really, really just seamless. But it was done out of a need because we're like, oh shit, we innovated way too low level. So now we have to rebuild the world.
Yeah, I'm just curious, because I think we're seeing that across a lot of industries right now. The way that we even think about recruiting automation at Dover is like, okay, now you don't need a whole team. You have some parts of the process taken off of your plate. So I'm curious how you met that friction. How did you convince people that this was a problem that they had and this was a solution that you had created for this specific problem?
Yeah. So I think it's like tiers. I think when you're starting off, I would call it whiteboarding them to death, where you're like, I need to explain to you, because the product's not there yet. So you're trying to explain to them how it works. Then when your product gets there, I call it like the magician demo, where you're kind of like, watch me do this thing, where it should seem impossible, but it's going to get you excited. And what I do is usually an ask me anything. I say, find a question that you've answered or you've asked that's taken your team or you have took you weeks to answer. And I don't know what the question is. I don't care what it is. You can ask me. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to live in this demo, answer it and give you a full analysis that explains what you should do live without me having any idea. And I would do it. And then that gets them like, once they start seeing me answer, they're like, wait. How? Like there's something, you clicked on a bunch of buttons, like what the fuck? And we end up diving deeper. I think that's like this. So you kind of give them you take the same experience they have and you give them like the same problem, sure, you go over to the same thing where like, this is the input, this is the output. This input output took you this long. Watch me do it in such a seamless amount of time. And then that gets people excited to learn. And then they have to understand the why it works better. Like, I think there's a moment where they go from being a, like an audience member of like, this is fascinating, to being a believer in this approach. And that takes a little bit more time in experiencing the product. And you continue building more. Like 90% of our product is to get people to use that 10% that is the innovation. But once the innovation clicks, you hear things that our customers would say is like, you can never go back. They're like, oh my God, how did I do data otherwise? And as to why I've adopted the tool, people have time more, people talk about it, they share about it. They're like, this is kind of great. And then it's kind of giving them the confidence that this will work. Like first, when you have nothing, you just preach the dream and you keep explaining. Then you kind of give them the input output through like a magician-like show. It gets them excited. Excitement leads them to interest. Interest leads them to actually understanding the innovation that separates you from your competition. And then the rest of it is alleviating concerns. Do you have enough customers? Who's using you? Will I get fired by using something so different? Does it scale? Will I have like regretted all these like human emotions that come with making this big different decision? Because you're telling them to do it. And like the good news about the world is that has a lot of examples. Tesla having to do that. Salesforce having to do that when they first came out. A lot of these big companies that have had to change how we work or behave. We work even to change how you work, like an open space, a community, and this like fuzzy thing that we were selling, which was community. Like you have to convince people that they want that. And you have to convince them that it's better. And you have to convince them to change their normal behavior. And people don't like changing. And you have to take risk because the first person who signs the contract, like they're either promoted or people, if anything goes wrong, they will yell at them. So how do you give them, those people who are your champions, the confidence to like run into battle with your tool? So that's kind of how we've done it.
I think it's so interesting how you describe it as it was a problem that was considered unsolvable and then you tackle it and then you show how it can be solved. But I'm curious, who do you demo this product to? Is it the end users of, is it the execs who use the product for decision making? Or is it the data engineers who are away from the decision making but actually do the...
Yeah, so I'm sure you guys have a very similar problem, which is like, who do you go to? So it's a very, very like song and dance. And the reason why it's a song and dance is just, if you sell to the executive, they're like, awesome, but they've also been sold and promised the same thing by another 100 companies that don't deliver. So they're always like, okay, you say you're going to answer questions, so does everyone. But like, you're going to tell me to get my team to do it. Looker says that they can answer your questions and they have helped make a lot of money, but Looker doesn't make decisions. Looker doesn't do it. It's a visualization tool. There's no way it can help you make a better decision. It's literally a visualization tool. So the person using Looker can do it. But like narrator is different. So the stakeholder is like, well, go to the data team. The data team is comprised in, depending on how large and small the data team is, they're optimized to save their job. Like, they're not incentivized to answer questions faster. No data person has ever been fired for not answering questions fast enough. If a poor data person makes a mistake, it's like, whatever. Like, as long as they're doing what's best practice and maintaining a system, they're no incentivized. So when you go to sell the data person, we have 7 or 8 slides called, like, don't worry, like, you're not going to lose your job. Like, it's like, that's the theme, because people are like, wait. Like, what do data engineers do in this world? And what do I do? So who you talk to is honestly, like, depends on the company. Like, we shine in companies that are really large, where there is, like, an embedded analyst trying to answer questions, so that the person making the decision and delivering data is actually much closer. Smaller startups where they don't have a humongous data team, or we call them jaded. So we look at heads of data where they're like, been fine. When we talk to them, they're like, I don't give a shit about visualization tools. It's not the problem. And I'm like, you're my customer. And then when I talk to you, you're going to be like, yes, you solved my problem, because I can, at least to that person, talk about the real problem. Versus when you talk to an executive and all these different people, you have to talk to them the problem that they view it as, not really the problem that you're solving. And like, it might be like the features of a sales CRM and the features of like a applicant tracking system might be very similar. You're still trying to track something going time with stages and tasks. Like, the thing that separates different tools is the language that they're speaking to a person. In data, that's super fuzzy, because people analytics and sales analytics are actually the same thing. So when you speak to someone who doesn't understand data, they don't look at them as the same thing. They don't look at your systems. So they're not going to appreciate your like standardization. They're going to be like, I don't care, like, answer my questions. And you have to deliver that. They do with the data engineer. Data engineer doesn't have to answer questions. So they're like, my job is to prepare the data. I don't give a shit about the questions being used. And data analyst is like, well, I answer questions, but if the data's not in a way I can use it, then I can't answer the question. So go sell this to data engineer. Everyone has like their own bubble, and you have to kind of align them all in a world where it's all seamless. And I'm sure you guys do the same thing with your customers, trying to get them to be like, you don't need 50 people and 50 different job roles and this person to do this thing. Like, there is a system that helps streamline this experience, and you have to show them that. But again, then you're risking jobs, and it's a whole situation. So long story short, we talked to a lot of different people, and we have a different sales deck, pitch, story for each one of them. And eventually they all come together and you're like, look, now in this narrator world, you can really seamlessly experience the goal, which is just to get your questions answered really fast.
Yeah, I love to hear that the struggles are similar across companies. As someone who's responsible for renewal, definitely feel the pain of, you know, the decision maker versus the user who will actually be using the product, and the whole question around jobs and job security. It's definitely a pain point. But obviously with the invention, or not the invention, but the advancement of GPT-4, how do you see the field of data analytics evolving, and how do you plan on perhaps staying ahead of the curve with that? Because I think a lot is changing very quickly.
Yeah. So ChatGPT-4 can write queries, but writing SQL is never the issue. It's like, that's like not a hard problem. There's a million tools that can write SQL. The hard problem is actually adjusting your data. So there's been like, Bob Moses from founder and CEO of Monte Carlo, she wrote a great article talking about this integration. And she says that ChatGPT can only exist on a standardized schema. And she references our work, which is Narrator has created the activity schema, which is the only standard schema in data. There's no alternative right now. So for any way of asking its questions, it has to be on a standard schema. You see that there's about 3 or 4 ChatGPT, 4 wrappers around the activity schema. So I think the world's going to do it. And like Narrator has, we have a ChatGPT implementation. The challenge is, I think, in getting a system to understand what the question you're trying to answer is. So here's a simple example. It's very easy to say like, let's assume your data is already clean and everything, but you're a master class. And you're like, does when we launch a class impact likelihood to actually get signers? Right? And everyone reads that question and goes, that makes sense. I want to know what time I should launch the class. That question is wrong. That's a really bad question. And it actually gives you the wrong answer. Because like, if you happen to launch the class at 5 a.m., but your email sends it out to everyone at 8 a.m., like, people actually experiencing your product at 8 a.m. is when they come in to visit the class. So the question you're actually trying to answer is, based on when the customer first sees this class, how likely are they to sign up? Because they might see it at 8 a.m., they might see it. It doesn't matter what when the database launches and turns that flag on. It's from that customer's experience. Getting a system to, when you ask that wrong question, to convert it to a right question is incredibly hard. We at Narrator do a lot of UI and UX tricks to help nudge you to ask the right question and be explicit. And like I said, most of the work done is actually helping someone rephrase their question. So like what we work with ChatGPT on is like, how do we help the user wrap their head around these questions that all sound the same, but like in the nuance is where the information matters. And how do you do it? Human back and forth is actually sometimes a great medium, but in like trying to get the user to refine their question, open-endedness is really bad. Like giving them like a restrictive form, it forces them to solidify their question in their head to put it into a form that has constraints. When you do with ChatGPT, you end up going back and forth, a lot of questions and forward, question and forward, question and question. And I think that's the process. So I see that's the problem that we want to solve. I lean toward the way that I always envisioned it, which is like more like a Amazon of insights, like where instead of you trying to ask your fuzzy question to it, like you're trying to solve a problem. Why don't you see how someone else who's has solved this problem and use their analysis? So like one of the things that Narrator does makes possible is allows you to copy and paste analyses across companies. So we have a store of our own analyses and algorithms and stories. So if you're trying to understand like your CAC or your marketing or like which attribution model should you use? Those are common questions being asked, and you can get like an expert analysis that has been tested on many companies. And I'd rather you search for an analysis and get like a thoughtful human written analysis that is trying to also counteract your common misconceptions and guide you. And I think that's where the world has to get to. I can't imagine ChatGPT generating that.
I agree with you. I think there's a lot of excitement around the possibility of it, but it's not necessarily like the level it would be at to sort of operate on its own. But something else I'm hearing too is that you're making data more accessible to everyone. Anyone in the company should be able to look at this model, ask whatever question they need, like effectively deleting the Slack channel of data requests that exists at every company. Instead of having a million data requests that take forever to pull, you can just have everybody asking the right questions. And I think that's something that a lot of companies are struggling with too, is figuring out how to educate their customers to change their process or use their product more effectively by changing their process. Have you found any strategies to be useful in going through this process? How else have you helped them learn how to use Narrator correctly?
So I have the policy of, instead of trying to we do this with our onboarding with most of our customers. We say like in the beginning, your data team is going to field the questions. And our job is to get the Slack request to be done in like under 10 minutes each request. But the difference is that instead of you sharing like a data dump, share them a link. And what happens when you share somebody a link of Narrator is that they start seeing the pattern, because Narrator is very pattern heavy, right? It is very consistent in how you do it. Because of a standard schema, you don't have to learn about the custom tables. You just have to learn how to like ask the questions. And it has a very clear language that makes it. So we see with customers that once they see it, they start learning how to do small changes. Like they have the data, they want to add another metric. They want to slice that metric by like customer attribute. They might slice it by a different feature. They might want to look at it by week, by month, by day. They might want to put it in their dashboard. So we make those things really easy from when you receive that link. Then we actually make it really easy for you to see exactly how everything is defined. So you can start tuning things. And once you get 5 or 6 questions answered through the links, what we see, and this is what our customers tell us, is that product manager, for example, starts going, wait, I can do this myself. So they might take one of their old links, duplicate it, and change a couple of the parameters and use it. And what we end up seeing is that it quickly becomes very, very easy for like anyone to slowly start using it. We say, data team, your job is to deliver it and then deliver in ways where they can do step 2 and 3 on their own. And our job is to make sure that step 1, 2, and 3 are really easy for them to do. And then through transparency and iteration, they eventually learn step 2. And then through that, they learn step 1. And then you're only getting questions where they actually have something hard. And that's what you want to be in. Like, that's what you want to do. You want to have that conversation where they're like, how do I answer this question that's more fuzzy? And you can guide them. I always do that with like our onboarding demo. We would do this thing where we say, like, let's take the feature backlog and let's see if we can tackle it with that data. We'll choose one data person. Let's take the next like 3 weeks feature backlog, all the data requests, and let's see if we can do them all within 2 days. And like, we've done this at demos where we had like the head of data go out to all the executives and make a list of all the questions they need answer. And we said, okay, we'll do like 30 questions in 1 week with one data analyst. And that data analyst becomes a superstar. But then also when they start sharing that, people start seeing their repetitiveness. That's the benefit of a system, is that your brain, once it starts seeing the pattern, your brain is much better than ChatGPT in finding patterns, and it will slowly be able to tune it and adjust, and then they can self-serve anything they need filtered.
Yeah, that's really it to me. But I want to pivot a little bit, because I want to get more into or talk a little bit more about your experience building the data team at as their first, you know, as their first hire. So what were some of the biggest challenges? You built it from zero, or I guess one person yourself, to 40 people. What were some of the challenges you faced in hiring, and what were the big roadblocks or lessons you learned from
that? Yeah, so I think the first biggest roadblock is there's this assumption that you have like, I answer 10 questions now, I hire another person, I can answer 20 questions. Like that's not how it works. So educating the executives on what the actual expectations of hiring is critical. Two, data systems are pretty big. The cost of maintaining a system, as answering 20 questions with one person is much easier. Answering 200 questions with 20 people should be much easier, but it's not, because then you have now, like, it's like you're building a house of cards. And as you add more and more cards, anything, the numbers don't match. And I'm sure you experience it. Hey, this doesn't make any sense. How did the number not match this number? Like, and those kind of things are really tricky. So they're likely for you to make mistakes. So I think when it comes to hiring, there is the setting realistic expectations of what the hires are going to do. We made the following the best practice. I think a lot of times best practices are designed by vendors, which is really, as now that we're a vendor, we like advertise and we do all these things. And you realize how much of best practices is designed by vendors. The reason why there's like a BI engineering job is because Looker needs someone to buy Looker and use Looker. Like, the reason why you have an analytics engineer is because DBT needs someone to. So you have all these jobs that you end up needing. And then there's always like shiny new tools to use. And you're like, oh, well, this solves this problem. This solves this problem. This solves this problem. And there's always someone trying to tell you how we solve their problem. So I think like one of the goods and bads mistake I made early on was I hired people and I bought lots. I was spending about over like nearly $1 million on tools. And we had a huge team, and it required a lot of rethinking of like, why does this happen? To realize that I was just like, you're just making so many decisions because everyone is making those decisions. So I think that was like one of the biggest learnings I had. In growing the team, I looked for a specific set of people that I think cared. And I, like early on, I was looking for people who understood the tech. Later on, I looked for people who, I used to call it choose boring. People who give no shit about the tech. If you can answer this question with like Excel and a Google sheet, like go ahead. But if you're like, let's spin up a Spark cluster and blah, 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 like you're just building more to be teamed. So I think like as a young leader, I was like very excited. I was like, oh, new tools, let's see all these things. And as you get more mature, you're kind of like, no. If we can have one tool do everything, let's do it in one tool. Simplicity is so critical because maintenance is death. And you have to hire more people to maintain the system. So it was a lot more pushing for simplicity and looking for people who cared about the outcome more than the piece. Because as you grow your team, you build segments. And as you have segments, those segments do their job, but they lose sight of the end of the day goal. So you have like, you've built like 20 wheels in this thing. Then you have to hire a product manager to help coordinate the car. And now you have another person, and it's just like, you have so many layers in, but like, there is an easier way where you actually build an end-to-end person who can do it all. And that's kind of why we switched to that model. I have adopted that framework very intensely. Like, we don't hire until we need it. We have data doing support and engineers doing support. Like, those kind of decisions allow us to solve things so much differently than like a customer success person. Like you, I'm sure you experienced it, where you're like reporting the bug to the engineering, that goes to our product manager, that gets put on a sprint, that sprint gets taken, that gets out of context, then it gets solved. And then you're like, wait, this is not what I actually asked for. Versus like a narrator, you're talking to, you have an issue, you're talking to a person who's like, oh, I know exactly what that is. And in 10 minutes, that's pushed, solved, and deployed. And we're like, that's a great experience. And you keep your product really clean instead of having like 7 people play telephone. So I think looking for people who like care about the outcome, looking for solutions that are end-to-end, helping you use an end-to-end experience instead of having to pipe together a bunch of specialized tool-based things. And then also realizing, us included, narrator included, every vendor is trying to change your mind, includes using their tool. And especially when they get together and they start marketing, that's kind of, I don't know if that answers your questions in a really long-winded way.
Yeah, I think it does. I have a follow-up question on that. So at Dover, I work with a lot of customers to help define their interview plans so they are able to decide on who they want to hire based on their needs. So based on what you were saying, it sounds like you're not only, you know, gauging technical skill set, but also the right type of attitude to work in an environment where there's no product manager or designer, someone who is open to owning it end to end. But how do you gauge this in an interview process, which is maybe a couple of rounds and doesn't really involve a lot of time?
Yeah. So I can give you, I do this with like, depending on the job, I have like a question that I design for every one of those jobs. For product people, I ask them, what product feature did you deploy and then realize it sucked and removed it from your product? If you remove things from your product, then you care about having a clean, simple product. Most people are like, nothing. People don't like removing things. And if you don't like removing things, then we're going to continue building up clutter. In data, I always ask kind of the questions of like, what's something that you built and like try to get to why. And then I try to say like, what's an alternative you would have done? And there's kinds of people who talk a lot about the tech and some people talk about the outcome. Like there's people who are proud of like, oh, I just jumped this thing in this and then did this and then like made it really easy and I got you the answer and it's really cool. And there's people who are like, well, I thought about the thing and I built tables and I added this thing and I added this new tool and da-da-da-da-da and I used something shiny and da-da. It's just like, you're going to get a very different experience from someone who talks a lot about the tech or what they were trying to do and did they find the simplest path to get there. So I think those kind of things are like really critical. I often ask, give questions and especially in data interviews, when you're asking someone who's a data analyst, I just give them a fuzzy question and like, do they start writing code or do they ask enough questions to understand what the hell the question is? If it's a machine learning or a data science role, I always love asking questions where do they understand why algorithms were developed? So I usually do like a, do you know a best fit line? And everyone knows a best fit line. And every data scientist will be like, of course I know best fit line. And then you say, great, how do I do a best fit line where no error is negative? And then you watch them be like, do you really understand what a best fit line is and how it's actually doing what it's doing? Or have you just like kind of learned how to shotgun algorithms to problems? And there's two kinds of people. Those who are like, who would stump, or those like, oh, actually, like this is what, how it does it. You need people who know the tools and choose not to use them. And so they're able to do things and they choose the simplest and easiest pathway. And their goal is aligned with that. If I was interviewing someone for HR, like with Dover, like I would be leaning toward, what is the goal? What are you trying to do? I want someone who wants to hire the best person in the simplest manner. And like, if I can do it with one interview, then great. If I can do it with 0 interviews, even better. There's a lot of ego in interviewing. And they're like, are you trying to like maximize the best talent for the lowest price? Or are you trying to like get someone to come in excited? At WeWork, I was notoriously known. I got in trouble for this multiple times where I would tell people, I'll be like, look, when I'd interview and then when it comes to salary, I'd be like, this is literally the highest I can give you as salary. And I would give everyone the exact, in my cap, because then we had a headcount, I'd give everyone, I'll tell everyone what I could give them and I'd give them the highest. And the CTO once came to me and he was like, hey, do you want to like get trained in negotiation? Like everyone you hire gets the highest amount. And I was like, oh, I just tell them that's the highest. And they're like, well, that's not how it works. And I was like, if you that's not the highest, give me a lower bar. But like, I don't know why I would ever like for my ego, give someone a lower salary range when I have a range to hire from. Like, if the range is wrong, please tell me otherwise. But like, if that's the range, I'm going to give the highest because I want my team to be the happiest and come in and make the most. And you get a lot more loyalty and people who really give it care. And it is a goal. And so I think that's kind of the stuff I look for a lot in, like, in the people who actually care about the outcome, or do you care about the process that you came up with?
That idea of, like, thinking about it a little bit differently than just like, okay, can you use the tool? Now, can you tell me the context of that tool? You did an interview where you talked about how hiring talented people isn't necessarily like the best idea for your startup or the best move. And you mentioned an experience hiring a designer too soon. And I'm curious if you could tell us more about that story.
Yeah. So in the beginning days of Narrator, so this is something that happens a lot with like VCs. You're like, I have a design problem. And they're like, hire a head of design. Like, I have a UX problem, hire a head of UX. Like, it's like simple, like, input outputs. So when we were hiring initially, I wanted experts. I wanted everyone to be experts. So we were averaging 15 years of experience. Everyone was super thoughtful and super methodical. At WeWork, I learned every 3 junior people you have to hire a senior person to undo their work. Just like the nature of like senior versus junior. Like, there's people who get it. You'll see good people don't write lots of code. Like, they write very little code. I'm sure interviewers, I'm sure you guys tell them, like, don't go through 1,000 interviews. Like, they're really good at screening. Good people do less work. It's just like the nature of it. So I was like, if you had senior people, you would solve this problem. The challenge came to be with applicable skill. Like, there is skills and there's applicable skill. So like, having someone who built a lot of e-com brands and is an incredible designer for a data tool, maybe not the best fit, even though they're super talented. And at the same time, hiring a designer to solve a design problem that was not, that's more of a, like, a thinking problem. Like, Narrator, when we were starting, people were like, oh, your product's really hard to use. And we kept thinking, okay, that's a UX and UI problem. But it wasn't. So because we were trying to change how they were doing it, we needed our new data model that we were to be like 10 times simpler than the current approach and retrain how people think. So we needed more like a person who was really good at educating and shifting people's behavior than it is as a UI or UX designer. It wasn't like where the buttons were or how pretty they were. So I think for us, what we ended up doing is we ended up shoving really talented people who had a tool set at problems that were not designed for that tool set. And you ended up resulting in that same mistake. Same with product. When we hired our first product manager, product's job was to build features. Like, that's what product does. They ship features. But our problem wasn't features. Our problem was our core thing needed to be simple to use. Like, it wasn't people wanted more capabilities in Narrator. They wanted to work in a seamless, easy way. And we had trouble because it was like a really difficult problem. So what we needed was like a lot of data people and engineers and people to come together to try to figure out how to rethink this so that it's easier. Like, our core tool, we built 9 versions of it before it is the current version we see now in Narrator. And then we built a product around that. So I think that when you hire people, like, they're going to use their skill set to solve the problem. But sometimes you don't need that skill set. Sometimes you need someone who's much, much willing to like figure it out. You might need a very different skill set. You might stretch people very weirdly. And I think that's like the key here. Like, that's my personal preference. And I think you should hire less. Like, less people that are good is the best. Like, that being said, the number one thing you cannot get away from is skill set. Like, what do you actually need them to do? And instead of just title, I think we spend so much time with title. And is that the title that you need? Because often so much titles are such bullshit, especially because startups have destroyed titles. This person was like head of growth and sales at this company. Like, you're like 22. Like, I don't know how that works. I think that's like really, really dangerous to start looking at titles. And it's really hard not to, because everyone applies based on titles. And it's just such a messy situation. We like to do the inverse. It's like, look for the skill sets that we need, then look for what that job would be called, and then hire for that.
No, I definitely agree with the title piece. I think especially with startups, they're very inflated at times. So it's definitely, you know, important to look at what the real experience is and what they've built. I'm also curious to hear about how you've built a diverse team. I know in the past you've spoken about how diversity is important for decision making. So how have you ensured that is happening at your company? It's hard to do it. So how do you approach it?
Yeah. Well, there's a bunch of things. I would say one, I'm not a white guy, which helps. I think starting as an Arab guy like is good. Building diverse team is actually not hard. It's like transitioning from non-diverse to a diverse team is way harder. Because like nobody wants to come in and be the first woman in a company. And nobody wants to come in and be the first diverse person, person of color in a company. Like that sucks. And it's going to be fucking weird. And more than that, the culture is you set up for them is really designed. Like if you, we don't use Slack. I think Slack is the worst thing ever. Passionately hate it. Because I think Slack has this idea that you're always on the computer. And then if you're not like there to respond in time, like you're just lost. Like I think one of the things that we noticed from employees that have kids is like, they love that we don't use Slack. They're like, yeah, if my kid needs something, I can get up, do it. And I don't have to worry that like I'll miss something on Slack. Everything is async. It's fine. It's like these kind of small things that you don't realize you're doing because of expecting everyone to be like this like person is really hard, right? When people come in, like they'll notice when you, what you give a shit about, honestly, is like based on your behavior. Like we care a lot about it. I think it's one of those things where like we'll interview people. They'll be like, oh, around we have two gray white guys. And I'm like, cool. Let's keep interviewing until we get two other non-white guys in the funnel. And then we can make a decision then. There's always this thing where like everyone's like, there's a fire. Well, we need to hire them now. And I'm like, no, we don't. We never do. Like, there's no fire. Chill. I think companies have a way of making it seem like if we don't push this feature out by Friday, the world can explode. Like, no one notices. So we take our time. Like, short answer, take our time to have the people who are in the company, like, be diverse. Well, like, you don't want to be on the team with, like, the 19 same exact copy and paste man. Like, you want to be in this other experience. So I think that's something that we hold important to us. Like, we are very anti-hoorah energy. We're not like, oh, like, I'm willing to hustle and, like, die for my job. And I'm like, I don't want you in the company. Or, like, nothing in the world should ever need more than 40 hours a week. Like, that's a lot of time. Like, what are you wasting your time on that, like, that's not enough to solve your problems? Like, let's figure that out. Like, nothing needs to be done now, like, ever. Allowing people to kind of have that freedom attracts the right people. And I think there's this whole thing where you think you can market your way into a diverse team or market your way into, like, a good engineering team. Like, you have to be the culture and the people that people want to work with. You got to treat them well. Be really honest and transparent. And I think those are the things that set you up for it. And there's a lot of people who want to do good work. Like, work is a very important part of our lives. It's not just money. Like, purpose is hard. And everyone wants purpose. At Narrator, we don't do deadlines. I'm like, I'm not going to give you a deadline. Like, I don't know what, who am I to tell you when this should be done? Like, I trust you. You do it when you're done. Like, sometimes it takes longer because you have to think about it more. Sometimes it's quickly. Like, I don't get this whole idea of me coming up with some random arbitrary deadline for you to abide by. So I think with all these things, you're kind of like, you're kind of just always going to be in that phase of like, be the company you want to like work at. And if you're happy with your job and you tell people come in and they're happy, and like, it just makes it a lot easier to get more people like you.
Yeah, I agree. It almost feels like Narrator has sort of, by nature of like, reconstructing the way you think about data, it's also reconstructed the way you think about working. Like, I don't think I've ever heard anybody say that they don't
think you've, just to add a note to that, I think that's actually what happened with us. I think because we're constantly reevaluating like what is actually needed in data, we ended up deciding to do the same thing with like so many parts of a company. Like when you eventually experience the opposite, you're like, why did we ever do that? Like, I think most people who experience no deadlines will start realizing like, why did I ever have deadlines? Like, it makes no sense. And the same thing with like Slack. Like, why was I always on the computer looking at messages to make sure I didn't miss something with 1,000 unread notifications? Like, that is anxiety producing. Like, how did I do that for so many years? And then you experience alternative and you're like, wow, this is like, I feel like at peace in my own head.
Yeah. And just before we go into our rapid fire round, I'm curious if you have any parting words, any last bit of advice. Obviously, you've had a lot of great insights and hot takes, and we love that. But anything else that you want to leave startup founders with in this current hiring market, whether that's from, you know, building their team or scaling the product, anything along?
I would say actually the biggest thing is there's no fire. Like, there's a lot of incredible talent out there, like a lot of talent. Like, there's no shortage of diverse, brilliant, incredible talent out there. And you just have to decide, or like, you've just spent time finding it. And if it's taking a long time, like, look into why you're not finding it. Not that it doesn't exist. It exists and it's really abundant. The last thing I'll say is also, nothing is like, we have a lot of stuff that's taken for granted because just like the way it's always been. I'll give a little analogy. There's a thing called like in the Toltec tribes from a different book. They talk about like this, one of the people that run into battle, they ride their horse backwards. And this is like a very notorious thing. And this symbolism is for everyone in the soldiers to always see somebody doing something so wrong to be reminded that there could be another way. And I think for all these things, we just kind of adopt all these behavior as like taken for granted, like this is just how it has to be. It doesn't. That's
it. Yeah, I love that. Those are great. But moving into our rapid fire questions, these are obviously a little bit more personal than first two. So what's a place that you go to typically to find inspiration?
Long walks. Like to some water and just like walk.
That's what I do too. I have a couple books, but what's a book that you recommend to people like a lot? What's
if they're business, I recommend Never Split a Difference. It just teaches you how to talk, communicate. And I think it's a great book. If it's personal, I recommend Conscious Loving, which is one of my favorite books in the world, by a great psychologist. It just tells you just like essence of love. It's been rebuilt as Conscious Leadership, which is now for like founders, and it's been redone by many, many different for like relationships amongst works. But the original Conscious Loving is a great book.
Cool. Awesome.
Love it. What's your favorite interview question if you had to pick one?
Oh, this is a really tricky one. I don't have like any clever questions. Like I have like specific questions I use, but what's your purpose? Usually is like what I care most about. Like how does the narrator help you in your purpose? And it's okay to just be like, I'm using you to pay my bills. And I'm like, great, that's fine too. Like that's a very great thing. So I think for me, it's just finding someone's purpose is like the key.
Yeah, it's good to have that clarity for sure. Final question. What's something you're really looking forward to right now?
Oh, so I just got engaged last week. So I'm excited for that.
Thank Love you. That.
Yeah, we actually met on LinkedIn.
Oh my gosh.
Fun fact.
No way.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah, we had like a, she was a cold outreach. So, and then now we're engaged. So I'm excited to just kind of begin. I'm moving to SF with her now. We both live here in Austin. And I think it's just an exciting part of transitioning your life as you kind of like unfold this new era. We're both founders, we're both CEOs. We have a pretty weird life, and just now doing it together will be a unique approach. So I'm excited for that.
That's awesome. That's really exciting. But yeah, Ahmed, it was really great chatting with you. And I think we've gotten a lot of great tactics and insights and strategies and a lot of great one-liners that I'm sure a lot of founders will pull out of this. So thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you guys for having me. I really, really appreciate it. It's been awesome.